one word, burr. 2026 has certainly made itself known already, with plenty of opportunity for extra care with our livestock, our land, and our extended families. And today we've got two guests sharing some of their experience. Justin Thompson is here from South Dakota to talk about being adaptive. Grazing is one aspect, of course, but adaptive just might be the starting point for all successes working with nature. And John Bryant in Virginia manages his family's old tavern farm. He's fourth generation, keeping busy with diverse livestock and crops. And I'm Robin, here for Cultivated Audio, January 2026. So grab some earbuds and or a shovel, and let's dig in. Justin, about 22 years ago, you got an uncommon start to farming and ranching on your own land. And I think it's such a great story to share about staying open to possibility.
Yes. It was 1998. By then, had graduated Votech school and high school, and there was an investor from Ohio that wanted to own and have a bison ranch. So he bought a ranch not far from where I had grown up. He'd gotten in contact with my dad and hired me, and I moved there to build and then manage and operate the bison ranch, which would be, it's north central South Dakota on the west side of the river. And because of drought and economic downturn, his bison investment lost about 95% of their value in 4 years. He decided to sell out, and it came at a time where it just looked like an impossibility for me to have anything to do with his selling. His decision to sell came at a time when my National Guard unit that I was in was activated for deployment to Iraq. I just hadn't left yet. So it seemed impossible, but before that day came of shipping, I was still working on the ranch. I had a really horrific accident happen miles from home, no fault of my own. I'd only been married a year, thankfully, that she was on the ranch, because I'd go great periods of time where nobody would have even known that I was lying out there. It took her 9 hours to find me once she knew something was wrong, and I'm thankful she did come and look. I was helicoptered to Aberdeen for surgery, and I was the last safe trip that helicopter took. The next life flight, they crashed, and everybody was lost while I was there in the hospital. And the opportunity came now once I knew that I could walk again and that I was going to have adequate enough recovery. I went to the landowner and I said, would you be willing to look at me as a possibility of buying your enterprise? And he was skeptical, but said, well, see what you can do. I went to FSA, which was a government county program that had funds set aside for first-time borrowers, and they were willing to take a position behind a commercial lender, but they had limits, and I maxed out that borrowing and went to the commercial lender and maxed out their ability to loan, and I was still way short. I had no equity. I owned nothing. I had 20 cows not paid for, a pickup and two horses, and just really didn't have anything other than hope. Anyway, I had a great relationship with this man. And if there is time, Robin, I'd love a chance to touch on the importance of relationships within agriculture. We had struggles in the time that I was working with him, and sometimes I would be flat frustrated with the situation I was in, and I would talk to my dad, and some of the best advice he gave me was, he's authority over me. I work for him. If he tells me to paint the rocks blue, paint the rocks blue and ask which shade. And I think that was really important, and I think that is what later on gave me the opportunity, because he said, well, I know you don't have anything, but I'm going to bet on your character. And he took by then a third position mortgage on his own ranch and loaned me through a contract for deed the rest of the amount of money that I needed to make the purchase. He didn't come down in his sale price, but he gave me the opportunity. I didn't even have money to buy cattle. I had to lease cattle. I had to work away from the ranch a lot. And anyway, the reason I'm here today is not because of my good decisions. In fact, I kind of figure I'm here in spite of my management, not because of my management.
Well, I don't know.
The opportunities that I had and the tragedy that is within the story, it doesn't let me take credit for being here. Because those things that all had to come together to make it work out that I could be here were all out of my control.
It's such a great reminder in so many ways. You just mentioned you want to speak about relationships and farming, and your story really leads into that, as well as adaptive management. As any farmer or rancher will tell, adaptive management is a key to success. How do you see the adaptive management within the regenerative system and what you've been doing? And would you share a couple of experiences you've been privy to that suggest following strict rules can be a good way to get into trouble?
Sure. Oh, great, great question, Robin. Context is so important. I got to say, at the time that we were adopting some of the practices, we didn't even realize for sure what we were doing. It was about survival. When we first started, when the appraiser came out for that loan, that year we'd had less than 8 inches of total moisture, most of which had fell in one blizzard. There was nothing there. A small car could drive across that entire range and see every hole, every rock, every gopher. There was nothing left when we took over, nothing there. We couldn't even borrow for infrastructure, but I started attending classes, holistic management classes, and ranching for profit schools and range management schools, and I saw it as completely essential. And they would lay out rules or guidelines. They'd lay it out in a black and white format as to say, this is what you have to do to become sustainable, before sustainable was even used.
Right,
very much. And we would bring those practices home, and we would just have trouble. Things just wouldn't work. The land that this is on is highly erodible land. It's classified as hell land, H-E-L. That soil is extremely fine, sandy soil. It shouldn't have ever been farmed, and yet there's miles and miles of these mounds, long mounds, that I didn't know what they were when I first moved there until I started fencing. We started building this bison ranch on some of these mounds, and I would hit barbed wires, and I realized those were drifted in fences from the Dust Bowl of the 30s. Land that should have never been plowed got plowed. And there is conventional agriculture in my area, but I had no ability to even pursue that, even if I had wanted to. What I saw that had to happen is the land was going to have to produce at the maximum ability to do so. And it wasn't going to happen if I stocked it wrong, managed it wrong. But these schools would give me blueprints and give me hope, and it'd give me great ideas, and then sometimes those ideas just wouldn't even work. Fast forward a few years, I was trying to implement intensive grazing because I do believe in the 6 principles of soil health and the 3 rules for adaptive stewardship. I believe in those. But to come about the answer to how to implement those on every ranch becomes very complex, because we have mineral tie-up issues that happen in livestock, and if they are forced to intensively graze, again, back to the relationships, but through the relationship of a vet and of the state range biologist who came out, I eventually found out I was having health trouble. We had one year we had to cut 6 fetuses out of a cow from inside the cow, and we had to reverse engineer what happened, and we went back and we found out I had an intensive grazed on an area that was extremely high in selenium and Astragalus plant family, the local weeds that we call it, Lambert's crazy weed, during the skeletal formation of the calf inside the cow. I locked that up by forcing them onto an environment and forcing them onto a plan that I thought was going to bring about good results. So since then, we've adapted it. I've never had that problem happen again. We've adapted our management. What works in some areas doesn't work in others. We were left with this farmland that was monocultures of tame grass that could produce a little bit for a short amount of time, but have no protein curve that would allow grazing for very long. But I'm stuck with huge amounts of debt, and I can't afford to just let the land sit. And that is what helped with these schools, was if you believe in the why you're doing something, you'll come up with the how. And I can't answer your how on your ranch very well without knowing the context and knowing what you've already tried and what you've already done. And so many of these problems arose from me trying to do the right thing and having the wrong thing happen. Through adaptive management, integrating cattle onto this range for short amount of times with large amount of rest. And so we've cross-fenced pastures. We had started at one time with 3, went to 12, and now we have 51 pastures that we rotate cattle on and off range. We watch range very close for diversity and health. And we found out through our adaptive practices that maximum production is not the answer, is not even desirable. My passion is native range and doing the best we can with it. I'm passionate about finding out the how because I believe in the why.
That's a great way of putting it. Thank you, Justin. And I just want to go back for just a moment to what you said about the mineral tie-up issues. So sure. That was due to more of a monoculture thing going on. There wasn't enough diversity, or were the minerals tied up in the land and not able to be released through the soil and the plant?
No, it's a great question. Thanks for the opportunity to complete some context. We've had other trouble too. What it came down to was when it was a bison ranch, they were allowed to completely select their diet. And they would travel and they would never stop moving, but they were selecting from most desirable to less and would never eat the bad weeds. But yet we were losing the right species of grass because of that constant selection for it. So the invasive cool seasons were taking over the native species because of that opportunity they had to nonstop. It would grow a teeny bit, and they'd bite it, grow a teeny bit and bite it, and they would never eat the rest of the plants that were there. So by cross-fencing, developing water, and by moving the cattle more often, we forced the cattle to expand their diet. But what I did was I took it too far extreme too quickly to an animal that hadn't adapted to what I forced them to do. And there are certain plants that will bring up minerals that other plants won't. And two-groove milk vetch in particular, and local weed, Lambert's crazy weed that I referred to before, there's at least 4 species that we have that I didn't know what they were. But the range, South Dakota range specialist that donated his own personal time, a job of one in the state that came out and personally walked with me, helped me so much. I escaped years of punishment from not knowing what's going on because of somebody else's willingness to help me. I always wanted to be that guy in the future, that guy that helped people that way.
Well, I think you are.
So we identified these plants that bring up imbalance of minerals, and the cattle then, I'm locking them on an area that forced them to eat something that they would not have eaten if I hadn't forced them into eating everything that was there. Where intensive management and mob grazing works in a lot of areas, I've got intense mineral imbalances in the soil. And the only reason we found out what that was collecting the data of what was going on and the way the cattle were reacting. We tested soil, we mineral tested soil, grass, water. We took liver biopsies, sent in frozen livers to Michigan State University. We found out where our mineral tie-up issues were, where the range areas were that had trouble, and we were able to graze them differently while still accomplishing the same purpose, but yet not subjecting our cattle to toxic things that are there. But I believe one reason that we do have it worse was many years of abuse allowed more of those plants to take over.
Sure. Do you think that the land had a lot of pesticide application previously?
Probably not in this specific area, almost none actually. It would have been way more from the tillage. In our area, the soils are too fine. We're mostly native range.
Yes.
If there's farm acres that they're there, they were so unproductive and yet plowed time and time again that the topsoil was almost removed entirely down to what looks like moonrock.
Right.
And
yes.
Then the government issued the CRP program, the Conservation Reserve Program, and pretty much all the acres were put into that program. But then they were never grazed with cattle, and they resulted in a monoculture of an undesirable grass.
Right. It's such an amazing statement, what you're talking about, for no tillage. Seems like a similar thing could have happened in a different way as far as rendering the land unusable from pesticides. But look what happened from this other direction.
Yep. Tillage for sure works in parts of the country. This is one area that it will not.
Mm-hmm.
Today it's blowing 35 miles an hour. And that is an element of nature that will subject the land to detrimental outcomes.
Right.
If man isn't careful about how they do it. And anything I say today, I want to make sure that it's clear. I don't have all the answers, but we never quit trying and we never quit adapting. If you close off relationships, you'll only get to a certain spot and won't be able to go better or bigger.
But right.
Humility.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people out there smarter than me. There's way better content now on the internet than me.
Well, I don't know about that, and that's definitely getting edited out, but it seems like all the farmers and ranchers I've spoken with, they learn by making lots of mistakes along the way, and then things really get presented very, very clear the more they do it and the better experience they have doing it. And I really think that the practical, spiritual, and poetry of life are equally accentuated in the relationships formed in life, and as a farmer and rancher, maybe particularly so in the regenerative agriculture system. You've been talking around this relationship importance in your life, and maybe there's a little more you would like to elaborate on within that.
I appreciate everything you said there, Robin, and you mentioned the pesticides before. Regen agriculture has contributed to saving my brother Roy's life, and it's no exaggeration. If any of your viewers or listeners would be interested, his story can be found in the short movie Destination Regeneration. I wouldn't take a lot of time, except his story is real. What Regen has done for him, but pursuing it, has brought about a life that not many of us in the family believed he still had the ability to live. And now he's trying to spread it to others. He makes himself available to share his story and tries to help people on a one-on-one basis. There's possibilities and there's hope, and there is exciting information out there. My story is under growingresiliencesd.com, and that is more based on just adaptive management, at least that story. My brother's story is about the life-giving ability that regeneration agriculture has. I happen to have just shared this story this weekend, so that's why it's kind of fresh in my mind, but judging how the question and answer went after the presentation at the South Dakota Soil Health Coalition conference, I realized that people are really interested in the relationship side of the regenerative agriculture. Again, I got to put the little fine print in there that I don't do this right, even though it makes it sound like I'm bragging on what I've done. We tried to integrate our children into our ranch, and I grew up never feeling poor, never feeling like we needed anything, but what was needed was my best attitude towards the work, because our whole family was in it together for survival. We milked the cow, we sold cream, we raised cattle, we raised range hogs. We did what we could to survive. I grew up during the 1980s farm crisis, and 250,000 estimated farms went under. Thankfully, somehow, we did not. I just remember the community helping one another where they could. I remember milking for other people that would have trouble, and for whatever situation is. I remember a tractor tipped over on my dad's foot one time, and I can still see the mental image of the neighbors that showed up to do all our work. We were all too young to drive legally, even though we all were, but I can still mentally see them doing all the work. I remember worst winter we ever had in the middle of a blizzard, our house burned, and we relied 100% on the community. There was never any question. Everybody just gave that way. And I really wanted my kids to grow up. My kids at a young age, they start taking care of the chicken flock and orphan calves, and they take care of horses. And soon, when they go into their kindergarten year, they get to pick out two heifer calves. The kids are subjected to real life pretty early.
Yes.
On a ranch. They learn early that there's consequences, good and bad, for the decisions they make. Even last night, in the howling wind and a blizzard, my second grader realized he had forgotten to do one of his chores. He bundled up, he went out, and he did it because that's the way I've seen is the best way to move forward. They learn fiscal responsibility pretty early. We start showing them the expenses of business, and they understand. My mom and dad gave me a lot of opportunities to play sports, but not all the opportunities. And my kids are the same way. There's a compromise where we definitely want them to experience life and social, but there's a responsibility here, and they know it. They, whether they always like it or not, they do know that they're needed, that they learn very quickly the consequences of the decisions. They're more likely to pick up a stray piece of wire out on the range that somehow got there. They're more likely to pick it up on their own without being talked to if they have to rope and tie down an animal to relieve them from a piece of wire that's cutting into their leg. There's sometimes I've questioned whether I should subject them to some of the trauma that happens. If I can get through this story without being emotional, but I have a picture of my 16-year-old daughter carrying a calf out of a snowdrift, and the calf is alive. And the point of the picture is a big smile on her face, because what doesn't show in the picture was 12 hours before, she had loaded the 30th dead calf from the same blizzard into the tractor. And we did all we could before, during, and after to save as many as we can, but sometimes we get these late spring killing blizzards that are just going to take life, and we do all we can. And I had an 8-year-old son and a 16-year-old daughter out there in that blizzard, and she broke down. She'd pulled the dead calf out of the snowdrift, and one of the mothers that had been going around trying to find her baby came running, which brought another one. And as she's bringing this calf that had froze, as she's bringing it back to the tractor, 20 cows showed up wanting that calf, and she just broke down. And it's one of those teachable moments of life that you explain there's a time for everything. So we do the best we can, and still, real life happens no matter how good we do. I share that story because sometimes we shelter the kids too much.
Right.
And they might not desire agriculture for their lives when they grow up. Hopefully, what they do learn here is something that will carry on no matter what they do in life. But regen agriculture, we keep the cattle out of the corral. We don't want mechanical cleaning or mechanical feeding. So the cattle are out on range nearly 360 days a year. We wean calves across the fence from their moms, not to traumatize anything. In fact, they both are kind of ready for a change. People don't realize sometimes that if you do things a certain way and change as little in the life of that calf as absolutely necessary. For example, I'm sorry, I got to back up for a little more context, but we place the herd of cattle in a certain pasture that is just perfect. Best grass, best water, best protection. And after a few days, after the mom has showed the calf where the water is, where the mineral is, what's safe, there's nothing spooky out here, here's the grass, here's the boundary, here's the fence, we take the mother away, but we leave her across the fence and they lay down next to each other. And eventually, the mom wants to go find better grass, and she leaves. The calf remembers where the best places were, and she leaves, goes the other direction. And we've done this for a lot of years, and we don't need antibiotic. It's been the very best way of health happiness and fulfillment in the situation with their cattle. Sorry to go so long on that one, but the integration of the children to our operation is just kind of deeper than trying to get free work out of them. It's more of a goal. It's more of a goal that established early through our holistic management. There's so many levels of relationships that I believe are important. But I do feel like we place unreal expectations of how others should treat us. Communication is needed to find out what they're dealing with, what life stage they're experiencing at the time. And you may never get along with them. You can still have relationship with them. I have close relationship with range specialists, with NRCS, with our vet, and even our lender needs to understand what we're going through. And I don't hide anything. We've had to restructure our debt so many times, and yet I've never missed a payment. The buyer who buys our calves, our steer calves, we do sell. The relationship I have with the buyer is a mutual win-win. The communication with the buyer, it kind of goes something like this. We follow the calf all the way through the life that they have with the person that buys it. And we say, how are things working? And how was health? How was disposition? How are things handled? And yeah, this was good. This was good. But we want to spend plenty of time with these calves. Could we maybe get them at a different time of year? Yeah, I think we can work with that. Let's do this differently. And then instead of sending us 600 calves in one day, we kind of miss some of the individuals that need help. Could we just spread that over 2 weeks? And then we say, well, man, that would work way better for us, because then we can also not rush a step somewhere else and provide a healthier experience for the calf that moves. And that's the kind of relationship importance that I think exists, because the same person has bought our calves for like over 20 years. That's what's wonderful about regenerative agriculture, is it gives the opportunities for these relationships to flourish, where the education about what we do can be shared with those that wouldn't understand agriculture like I do. I'm floored when I hear accusations towards agriculture sometimes, because it's not what I see. Even the relationship we have with our cattle, when we move cattle, I want to make sure that they don't think I'm a predator. So we spend a lot of time with them. When we move them, I tell the kids, think in terms of, let's pick one direction they can't go, and let's just pressure and release towards the direction they need to go. And eventually the animals trust us, knowing that when we are there, a better experience is coming. They're headed for fresh grass, and it isn't a predator runaway relationship. It's a pressure and release relationship, because there is zero benefit to us having them scared.
Yes, it all goes back to the trust, and that is also like throwing the pebble into the pond. It just reverberates from the land to the animals to your customers and your clients, everyone in your community. And I talk to people all the time, and I'm talking to people that are doing the regenerative system. So I'm like, yeah, this is everywhere. It's happening all over the place. And yet it's minuscule. I get tricked by myself all the time. And yet, what a lovely life to do it that way. When we can have a more trusting world, that'll be where we all want to live. Justin, what, like, even in one sentence, what's your favorite part of your day?
Wow, Robin. Every season is so different, and I'm usually looking forward to the end of it and the beginning of the new one in a cycle. But yet, the favorite part of my day, I guess, is to know that my struggles are handled because I'm a Christian and I see the world through that worldview. In knowing that even despite my biggest mistakes, good is still possible. Mm. Robin, I'm sorry. I don't think I talk in single sentences in anything.
That's fine. That was a great answer. And then just one more question for you, Justin. What's your favorite cut of meat?
Hamburger.
You're not alone.
I know.
We are experiencing a little bit unusual weather for Virginia. We've had a bitter cold front come in, and we had some snow yesterday. So things are snow covered here. And then we're expected to be in very chilly weather through the end of January. Like in the lows in the 20 degree range and highs not really above 40, which of course is somewhat problematic for us.
Sure. What's the thing that comes to mind first?
We grow year round.
Yes.
Because as our average temperatures have increased and our winters have become more mild, it's allowed us to do that. And now we are having more of historically what you would say is a normal winter, maybe a little on the cold side, but more normal versus more what we've come accustomed to in the past 5 to 8 years or so, which is much more mild. And so everything from our crops being able to continue to grow, let alone suffering ultimately damage from the multiple days in a row below freezing, where it'll actually kill a lot of the crops. But also crops that are tolerant of the cold, we can't harvest them frozen. We have
yes.
to wait till it thaws. Even if it's 25 degrees at night, usually by 9 o'clock on a sunny day, everything's thawed out and we are in the mid-50s during the day. So survivability of crops and then harvestability of crops.
Right. And how do your livestock do in these situations?
They love it. livestock animals thrive in the cold versus the heat.
Yes.
The heat is much more problematic on livestock. We have adequate shelter should they choose to use it. That's the operative word. We can build the nicest protected shelter. And 80% of the time, the hogs, they don't ever even go in it. They'll dig down and make a little wallow. A lot of times what we do is we just took some fresh straw out where they've been most recently sleeping at night and scattered it around, and they enjoy that. It's windy, they'll shift to a more protected with some trees or a down tree or something to block the wind. The breed of chickens that we raise, a heritage breed, same thing. When I first got chickens and I read everything, hoping to learn something, and everybody talked about designing your coop so it was free of drafts and all that sort of thing. And because our chickens, many of them are truly free range where they are not fenced whatsoever, they roost in a tree. And that's when I'm like, they don't need any protection. They get up in a tree and sleep all night just fine and prefer to.
Yes. Boy, this is adaptive management once again, 101, right? It just continues throughout all time.
Yeah. When we first started raising chickens 10 plus years ago, I got so frustrated. I was like, if I ever have time, I'm going to write a book that is titled The Truth About Chickens. And it's like the first paragraph is probably going to be, you can believe this, but don't believe anything else you read.
Right. Or it would just be totally empty book, right? The truth. There is no truth about chickens.
Yeah. My experience was I learned a lot of information that just was not accurate or applicable.
Well, it certainly is a farm by farm, year by year, day to day, follow your vision, right? And John, tell us about Old Tavern Farm. You're in Virginia. Your grandparents were farming that, so you are fourth generation. Tell us about the size, the geography, rainfall, and what types of livestock. You've mentioned the pigs and the chickens. So you now have both meat, chickens, and laying hens. Is that correct?
Correct.
And then you have cattle, too.
And then we also even have some goats as well.
Oh, great.
But the goats, they serve a purpose on the farm, but they're essentially pets because they're rescued dairy goats.
Oh.
So they're the males. that are not necessary for dairy goat production,
right?
Because they don't give any milk. so yeah, we've got the laying hens, we have the meat chickens, and then goats, and then hogs as well. And we have dabbled in beef, and we want to get back to that. We just had some issues with availability of pasture land. The land is very, very well suited and productive for what we say row crop agriculture,
yes,
which is your corn, soybeans, wheat, barley, those sorts of crops. So there's not a lot of available pasture land around us. The farm has been in our family for four generations. My great-grandfather purchased this farm in the late 1800s. And then since that original purchase, several generations have added on to where now the farm is right at about 400 acres, both our arable land that we farm as well as timberland. And then specific to our vegetable production and fruits, we farm on 60 acres, and then we have an additional 70 acres that is used for the livestock.
So how many livestock do you have?
So with laying hens, we try and keep around 200 hens at all times, and we purchase new hens, usually about 60 to 70 hens every 6 months, and that keeps our flock at peak laying capacity in order to have a consistent supply of eggs. And then what we do is, as our hens age out, they're still productive for another 3 to 4 years. They just reduce the number of eggs that they actually lay per week. And we sell those birds to your backyard egg enthusiast. And they love them because they're already laying. They don't have to raise them from chicks. They also know that they're getting hens. That can be an issue, A, from personal experience. People will swear up and down that they're selling you hens and half of them will be roosters. And then it's your problem to figure out what you want to do with a rooster. And then meat birds, the chickens that we process, those we grow close to 1,000 birds a year. But in our climate, the type of bird that is raised will not survive much below 40 degrees. And so in our area, we all take a hiatus from about November through March with our meat bird production. Usually in late February or March is when we get our first chicks, and we have them in a heated brooder for the first couple weeks before they go outside. We want to get them as soon as possible because usually through the winter, we have sold out of our meat. And we need to get back into production.
Right.
But we have to be very attuned to what the weather is doing. And then hogs, we market about 100 to 120 hogs per year. So those are the feeders that we raise for meat because we're what we call a farrow to finish farm. So we have our breeding stock. We typically keep two boars, and then we have anywhere from 6 to 10 sows to be able to keep that production of the feeder pigs going.
Well, you are a busy man, needless to say.
Yep.
Not unusual for a farmer or rancher, but still.
Yeah.
You said that you brought on the meat chickens most recently than the hens and the pigs. And how did that change your day? What was it like integrating a new type of animal into your rotation?
Well, it was certainly the learning experience. As I mentioned, when I first got chickens, trying to figure out how to do it, basically. With the meat birds, we were fortunate that we know a couple other farms that have been raising meat chickens for several years. And so they were a good source of information in terms of the housing, particularly because our primary goal with the meat birds was that they were going to be very much incorporated and an integral part to our regen ag. And so the common term for the housing that each group of meat birds is in are chicken tractors. And what they basically are is a protected housing, but it is open along most of the sides. One or two sides or a half a side might have some kind of barn metal to block the wind or you know, rain elements like that. And then it has the same metal as a roof, but it typically is only 2 to 4 feet tall, something like that. Some of them have wheels on one side or all four corners. Two people, or you can hook it up to a side-by-side, an ATV, or a small tractor and pull it. But every day, we move it slightly throughout the field or pasture that the birds are in.
Right.
So every day, they are on fresh ground, essentially, that they will then scratch throughout the day looking for grubs and insects and mice and the different natural things. They do eat greenery, you know, the different weeds, the grasses, whatever's growing in the ground. And then they're supplemented with a feed to make sure that they're getting their complete nutrition as well as the minerals that are key to their growth. Typically, we have two or three people who on the farm are trained to be able to deal with the different livestock. For the health of the animals, that care when the same eyes are on them day after day.
Of course.
Because you notice trends. You know, there's different elements of biosecurity that we implement on the farm to protect our livestock. Same eyes are on the bird. There's that consistency of making sure and being able to notice the general health, feed consumption, what they're doing to the ground. The benefit to us is that as we move them through a field, they are scratching the ground, they're turning it over, which is great for the health and biology of the soil. They're essentially aerating it and adding a little bit of oxygen to the soil. But of course, what they're really doing is they're leaving behind the chicken litter, the manure, which has nutrients in it. Typically, what follows the birds is going to be a intended crop for vegetable production. That is one of the critical components because in that manure, what they're leaving behind is nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and a variety of micronutrients as well. Starting in the early 80s, maybe even a little bit the late 70s, many farmers started switching to what we call no-till agriculture. And this is in your traditional row crop is where it kind of started and really where it continues today and has some of the biggest impact because of the scale of row crop farming. With that, really the key was the development of a planter that could cut through that previous crop residue, whether it was corn or soybean or wheat. Now, like on our farm, our row crop land, we haven't tilled that land since probably 1982 or 1983.
Oh, beautiful.
And so that was really the first step in that process. And we have a great state agency, and I think many states have it, but here in Virginia, it's our soil and water conservation districts that all farmers, no matter what they're growing, work with closely. And one of their biggest impetuses is no-till, but is also cover crop. They are training farmers, providing assistance, technical assistance, some even financial assistance. Anytime your land is fallow, well, that also means you're going to grow a lot of weeds. And if those weeds go to maturity, well, then they're going to produce seed and they're going to increase your weed seed. You know, like in our situation, we may have a field of broccoli and cabbage and cauliflower. And in the fall, when we harvest that in October or November, we do still need to use tillage. There's different methods now, what we call conservation tillage, which is much less invasive. We try and leave certain percentage, and we can use different tillage tools to leave a greater percentage of crop residue on top of the surface,
yes,
which helps protect that soil. But what we do is we immediately come in and plant a cover crop. And that cover crop may be anything from rye or hairy vetch or Australian winter pea or clover or buckwheat or sun hemp. There's a host of different things that we use depending on the time of year, what the growing season is, how long we want that cover crop to establish itself. We want to have as short a period as time, because that bare soil, if it's windy and dry, that soil
bye bye. Can blow. Yeah. And John, as far as growing season and of course this cold spell right now aside, but Virginia is located kind of in a sweet spot for cover crops.
We are. We definitely are. One of the things that's been so interesting is Zach, our farm manager, and I just attended the Southeast Regional Fruit and Veggie Growers Conference. And in attendance there is Big Ag. I mean, straight up, all the names that you would associate with Big Ag are there. You know, and they look at it as, this is where our customers are. This is where we make money. But what was so interesting, one of our biggest focuses in attending this was to learn more about what is being referred to as biologicals.
Mm.
And biologicals can be anything from a nutrient to help plant growth, to help soil biology. In some cases, it's adding different bacteria to the soil as we plant or doing it pre-plant. One of the more interesting things when we start talking about nutrients, basically, it's a bacterial amendment that we add to our water when we transplant the plant, and it contains a bacteria that colonizes on the roots of the plant. It creates a microbial area that pulls nitrogen from the soil and from the air. There's tremendous environmental benefit impacts to that. What it's doing is pulling that nitrogen, and it's in an available form that helps the plant grow. But then what it translates to is we don't have to put down synthetic nitrogen because we're capturing it from a natural source. And then that goes all the way in to the cycle. Like when we grow a cover crop legume, well, that adds nitrogen.
Of course.
And, you know, if we grow vetch and we let it go to the flower stage, when we till it in, it's going to add about 60 pounds of nitrogen. And then when we use our manure from our meat birds, that's probably going to add another somewhere 40 to 60 pounds of nitrogen. So now we might be up in that 120-pound range.
Amazing.
And then it's through this biological amendment, it's a range anywhere from 10 pounds per acre up to maybe 30 pounds per acre of nitrogen. If we start getting into that 150 pounds of nitrogen range through natural sources, we're getting to the point where there may not be a need for a synthetic nitrogen.
Now, John, is your farm certified organic?
We are not. We went down that path probably 10 years ago or so. I was full steam ahead to certify organic and was doing 100% organic practices. And as I got more experience, and particularly as I talked to some certified organic farmers, and one in particular that's a good friend of mine and is in this area, we were both at a meeting at the USDA. She made the statement. She said, if I had to certify all over again, I probably wouldn't do it. And I was like, what do you mean? You've been certified for 20 years and you're saying you wouldn't do it. She's like, well, I wouldn't change the way I would grow. There was kind of a couple things, and one was the expense that is there. And it's not just the expense of the certification process. The inputs that you use when you're organically certified, called OMRI,
yes.
O-M-R-I,
mm-hmm.
are unbelievably expensive. and limited. Take spinosad, which is an organic insecticide. Well, the OMRI listed version of spinosad is for a quart $500-$600. But there are four or five other spinosad products out there on the market that are just as effective, but they're not OMRI listed. And they're half the price.
Sure, yeah.
Well, instead of Entrust, I'm going to use Conserve.
Right.
Instead of paying $580 a quart, I'm going to pay $220 a quart.
Yes.
And it's the same product. The other part of that was, which is really driven, and I see because we do particularly farmers markets, but you also see it in the wholesale side with grocers, is the many farmers, like at farmers markets, have started using terminology like beyond organic and
right.
no spray and naturally grown. When we talk about the different things you hear about the different ways food is grown, I would tell the consumer is what to look for is transparency. When you shop local and you have that opportunity to engage with a person involved, take the time and ask them about it. Because they are passionate about what they're doing, you're getting educated, and then you can make an educated choice.
Beautiful. Through your knowledge, I can tell you have your finger in every little pie that's involved with Old Tavern Farm. What's your hobby? What do you do to separate yourself for a moment?
That's a loaded question. I used to be an avid runner. Half marathons, marathons, and had a wonderful community. I enjoyed the races, but what I really enjoyed was training because so many of them were group runs. But unfortunately, COVID, like with many people's activities, kind of did away with some of that. And then the other contributing factor is as this farm has grown, I spend so much of my time farming.
Right.
And managing the farm and all of the tasks associated with it, that I have gained 20 pounds and I don't think I could run a mile right now. So,
well, maybe a better question is, being a farmer as you are, what's the favorite part of your day?
Boy, probably being in tune with nature. You know, not only being outdoors, but you're paying attention. You're listening. It's one of the things some of the employees on the farm, and do it depending on the tasks, I'm like, that's fine, wear your headphones. But in a lot of ways, I'm like, you need to be able to hear. Because if a pig is screaming, there's a lot going on that you start to notice when you take time to notice.
Thank you to Justin Thompson and to John Bryant. And today I also might point you in a backwards direction to Cultivated Audio's October 2021 to hear Jim Garrish speaking about livestock feed and foraging in the winter. For anything we do, it's cultivatedaudio.com and our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being here and for helping make Here where we all want to be.